Let me ask the question because I'm not quite sure whether it's, you know, I hear it on ads and you never know. Are we energy independent today?
No. North America, Canada, United States, Mexico could be energy independent. We're importing a whole bunch of oil still.
But you could replace that oil with natural gas that you have. You know, so energy independent, you are energy independent.
We could
if
be.
You manage your resources and get rid of, if you want. But when you get rid of that, you're going to get rid of Canadian oil and Mexican oil, which I don't want to do. And you don't either. You said you'd like to see them all put together.
I would like a deal made to pay attention to the climate as well. That's what I would like.
Carol, are we energy independent?
We are certainly less dependent, and hopefully that will allow us to make wiser decisions about wars we fight and things of that nature. But, you know, ultimately, I think the real test is what are we doing on carbon and what are we doing in terms of our energy use while we drive down our carbon emissions? And that's on both the transportation and the electricity side.
But, Joe?
Well, we could be and we should be, but it's hard to explain that we're energy independent when we're still buying so much oil on a daily basis, six, seven.
I can explain it real quick.
Okay.
Because the natural gas will replace the oil if you want to use it for transportation.
Well, we agree on this is basically is transforming our transportational fuels.
T. Boone, first question goes to you. Is the price of oil really a factor of supply and demand, or is it politics, power, and control?
Well, EPA sets a price for oil.
That's right. And we do a damn good job of it.
You're doing real
it's
good
really
right now.
It's really cheap right now.
It's not a free market for oil because we all will accept the fact that OPEC is a cartel.
Right.
And they will adjust supply to fit if the price goes down. Now, I've got to go so far. Now, 3 months ago, they came up with a new policy.
Right.
They are not going to reduce supply to get the price of oil up. They say that we, the United States, is to blame for the price of oil dropping from $100 a barrel to $50 a barrel, which is true. We produced too much oil in the United States, and we did cause the price to go down. We're the cause. The Saudis are 100% correct. When Naomi tells you that I'm talking about now for Saudi Arabia, he said, we're going to produce 9.6 million barrels a day, and we're going to keep our market share, whatever the price of oil is. If it goes down, too bad. Let the one that produced too much oil, the United States, is the one to adjust down. Well, the United States does not have a state-owned oil company. And Saudi Aramco is owned by the Saudis, and they can adjust their production down. In the United States, you can't tell 1,000 producers that we're going to adjust it down. Now, if I could take 2 minutes to tell you and take you back to the 60s, when in 1970 we reached all-time peak in the United States of 10 million barrels a day. And at that point, we were the swing producer for the world. And if I had a well that would produce 100 barrels a day, then I could produce 3,000 barrels a month if that was the allowable. That's not the way it worked. They said, we're going to cut back on producing days. And so in the 60s, you went back to 26 days a month. You could produce 100 barrels a day. Then you went down to 22, and you went clear down to 8. Because of the price of oil, the Texas Railroad Commission was trying to adjust supply to meet demand and keep the price up.
Was a state agency doing this?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah, Texas was a swing producer, is what it was. We assumed that role of swing producer. This is in the 60s. So in 1973, you had the Arab embargo. Now, my God, we were cut off from oil from the Mideast. And they turned to Texas and said, turn it on. Give us the oil that we've been pinched back on. Well, we found out that the wells had declined. And my 100-barrel-a-day well wouldn't produce 100 barrels a day for 30 days. It wouldn't to get, I had produced 30 days to get 1,500 barrels. Mm-hmm. That's when we found it. They said, why don't you turn on the oil? We did turn on the oil. We didn't have it. It wasn't there. And so we no longer were a swing producer. Then it went to the cartel and the Saudis. Is the price of oil, is it a free market? No, it's not a free market.
Carol, have you changed your position on the further development of domestic nuclear power? And do we actually have the ability to control this technology in a reliable and safe manner?
So I have changed my position on nuclear. I used to be opposed to nuclear, and about, I don't know, 15, maybe 12 years ago, as I started to think more about carbon pollution, I realized that it just wasn't, I couldn't have a position on carbon-free energy and oppose nuclear, which is carbon-free energy. About 20% of our base load electricity comes from existing nuclear power plants in the United States today. And while we're trying to reduce carbon from burning fossil fuels, we can't simply get rid of a source of electricity that is carbon-free. You know, building new nuclear in the U.S., Stephen and I, when we were part of the Obama administration, tried hard, and we had some success, but it's very challenging because nuclear sells, nuclear-produced power sells into the market at a higher price point than other electricity. So, for example, natural gas is very cheap right now. That's selling into the market at a much, much lower price point. If we had some sort of restrictions on carbon, that would start to probably change that pricing differential. But I do think that...
That you wouldn't use natural gas?
No, you would use natural gas.
It's cleaner than anything else.
It's not cleaner than nuclear.
Okay.
It's not. Nuclear is carbon-free, and natural gas is definitely cleaner than coal, mm-hmm. But it is not cleaner from a carbon perspective. Yeah, and the other thing I came to appreciate is that while obviously Three Mile Island did happen in the United States, and you had horrible things at Fukushima and you had Chernobyl, the nuclear power industry has had two deaths in the U.S., too. They were both accidents involving people working in the facilities, obviously very tragic. The fossil fuel industry has just struggled with a lot more health issues in terms of public health consequences, in terms of worker safety. You've been, you know, out front and very outspoken mm-hmm. on some of the mining incidences. And so, yes, I am pro nuclear.
You know, two accidents, the oil and gas industry has had two accidents. The one, the BP blowout.
That was kind of a big one.
And what?
That was kind of a big one.
Well, well, you had 11 people get killed.
I know. And a lot of oil.
Well, but the oil has been pretty well absorbed into the environment now. But let me go to the second accident. You only had two accidents.
An Exxon?
What?
An Exxon Valdez?
Well, that was a drunk...
was still an accident.
No, I said blowout.
Oh, blowouts. Okay, yeah. So you had BP, you had the Macondo, which is BP. What's the other one?
Santa Barbara.
Oh, Santa Barbara.
Yeah, in the 60s.
Those are two major blowouts. As you well know, there are a lot of blowouts in the oil industry.
Well, a lot of blowouts. I mean, there. Okay. Well, wait a minute. Laugh.
No,
but hold on.
But those two had major environmental consequences.
Yes,
that's
they
what
did.
We're talking
I agree.
About.
See, and Valdez was.
Valdez.
Yeah, but Valdez was a drunk bus driver that hit the big rock in the Valdez Canal out there.
That's true.
He did.
Steve, let me just pick up on the nuclear issue because of you've looked at this issue, It's been a while since we've been able to put a nuclear plant back on. I guess there are two units in Georgia that have just been approved. And I guess we'll go in, 2020 or something like that. But when you look at nuclear power, and, you know, there obviously have been so many different versions of nuclear plants. Standards have varied. How could we possibly... But still, nuclear produces a good chunk of our electricity, and it's true abroad as well. So, how do we try to improve so that nuclear power can be much more viable What's the secret?
Well, first let me describe the problem. The problem is we, the United States, but actually the world, hasn't built a new generation of nuclear power plants for a while. There's one going up in Finland, one going up in France, two in the United States, and maybe another two, but maybe not. And all of them are behind schedule. The one in Finland and France are like three times the cost, and way behind schedule. And when you, and that's what actually, before Three Mile Island, the nuclear power plants were getting more and more behind schedule. Companies were going bankrupt because they were borrowing, you know, by the way, cost of a 1 gigawatt nuclear power plant weighs in about $8 billion. If you can bring it on schedule on budget, could easily go to $10 billion or more.
But Stephen, what was causing those overruns?
There were a number of things causing the overruns. One is that every plant was slightly different. And then the NRC had to do a whole new licensing for every plant. You should have made standard plants as much as the same. There was cost overruns, there was higher concern. First, Three Mile Island, Chernobyl, bad.
Mm-hmm. Fukushima, that was a poor design really, plant, right?
The Chernobyl plant was an old reactor design from the days of Fermi that was known to that could go unstable.
Yeah.
The Fukushima plant was a GE Mark I design. It was a first generation nuclear power plant that no one ever thought would have this complete meltdown. Reactor number one at Fukushima, the whole bottom of the reactor, by muon energy, it's now melted down and passed through the reactor into the container. It's
but we know now that you would never build a reformer on a fault. And we have done, should never.
Well, we have, this is your sensitive territory here in California about that.
That's
right.
True.
Stay off. Put them inland.
No, you can't.
You put them near the water.
You got to put them
water
near a major water. River or an ocean for
water.
The cooling.
You can get water.
So
yeah,
anyway, but look, it's a complicated issue, but there's a fundamental economic thing. If you can't build them on budget on time, no bank would ever loan you the money. It's just too risky. You know, there were a number of utility companies in the United States that went positively bankrupt because they were delayed and late and just went bankrupt. Yeah. Then they were bought up by another utility company, 10 cents on the dollar. And yet even today, when the full cost of the nuclear power plants, they exist today, they're totally written off. But the way we sell electricity in the United States is you do day-ahead bidding. 90% of the electricity sold today is you go out to an open market and say, the utility company says, who wants to sell me electricity tomorrow? At what cost? Natural gas is dominating this day-ahead bidding. 95% of electricity sold that way. Nuclear power can't compete with natural gas, so they're losing business. Now, it's a funny thing. What about wind? You know what the natural gas guys do? They say, you know, if the wind blows, we'll buy it from wind because it could be really cheap because of production tax credits and a number of other things. But we can guarantee the supply of energy. And meanwhile, nuclear, which is a totally written-off plant, totally depreciated, existing, may have 20 years, you know, they can't use it. And so our energy security, if it goes all to natural gas and nothing else, is very scary. You want a mix.
What's scary?
You want a mix of energy in the United States. I want to see wind, I want to see solar, I want to see not all natural gas. You want a little bit of other mix as well as a little bit of nuclear. But the
you're not saying a little bit of natural gas because you got a base load.
I think, you know, in 30 years, 40 years, we could be half renewable.
We'd be half what?
Half renewable. California by, what is it, 2025?
Right. Yeah. Half would be renewable.
32% of California by 2030 will be renewable.
That's their commitment.
But the entire national grid's not
new. I'll be 102 then.
He'll still be around.
He'll still be alive. You said you were
going to
live to 114.
That's what the doctor said.
No,
I didn't say
that. No. If you're really kind of interesting and ordinary, you're going to live a long time.
Get this thing done quicker.
But I'm just saying the economics of nuclear is very, very bad at the
moment.
It's tough.
Let's go to Joe. Is Is, in fact, the idea of, quote, clean coal a myth produced by coal companies to block, delay, or stop federal regulations designed ultimately to prevent the burning of coal and its impacts on global warming?
Well, clean coal technology is basically, can you use the product in a cleaner fashion? We don't, I mean, people are visualizing we're going to wash it and make it somehow cleaner. That's not going to happen. But the bottom line is it's a resource that has made the country what we are today. We're the superpower because of the natural resource that we had, domestic coal in this market. If it wasn't for that, you wouldn't be the superpower sitting here today. If we had to be buying our energy from other countries as we were developing, we wouldn't have what we have. So with that being said, if someone came to me, and I've said this before, and they said, we have a new fuel in the future, and in 5 years we're going to transform into commercial hydrogen. Well, you know, fine, we'll do it. We'll be part of this great country, and we'll make our economy adjust to that. But that's not the case. You're going to use fossil. The world's going to use more than ever in the history of the world, and we can do it and do it much better. But the technology is not there. Give you an example. They've gone to, at first you were going to carbon capture sequestration, finding out that that has not been economically feasible. No. The Kemper plant's $2 billion, which is an AEP plant down in the South. Southern Company has it. So they've taken that off. Now they're going ultra supercritical and trying to base it off of that and another plant up in Canada. And so they're all over the board. The bottom line is we don't have the technology under commercial load. And I've just said this. If you're going to do it, then the federal government's got to jump in with both feet. Private sector's got to meet them and jump in with both feet. And they've got to design the technology that works. Then put it under commercial load. That means put it out in the field, make sure this plant, let's say 500 megawatts or greater, will run for 12 months under load. And then that should be proven technology that we can do it.
That's going to be expensive.
We're not there. We're just not there. So they're setting standards for us to be there, and we're not there. Well, the coal, 7 billion tons of coal, wipe us out completely. The United States, we don't burn another lump of coal. There's going to be 7+ billion tons still burnt in the world, and it'll be burnt dirtier than ever. And we're not doing anything about it, and we keep talking about a global climate without even trying to jump in the market for a global fix. I'd rather do it here. And we're willing to, and we're doing everything humanly possible.
Let me ask you, China is putting coal plants in, but is China trying to develop clean coal?
Oh, yeah, they're doing it off because they don't have to go through the rules and regulations. The bottom line is China can do it at their own. And I will say this, China has the ability to do it in a much more rapid timing. But also, China, here's the thing that China knows. Anytime you put on these clean technologies, it takes away from the production of commercial power. So let's say you had a 900 megawatt plant and you do carbon capture sequestration, full carbon capture in a commercial plant. You might use up to 30% of that power in order just to capture it. So you build a plant based on 900 megawatts of commercial sales, but you only have 600 megawatts to sell. So when the president said, go ahead and build it and it'll be broke, you'll be broke, you can't do it. It's commercially not viable. We need it, and we're willing to move to the next technology. We're just not there. And we haven't, I don't think, developed and put enough money.
I agree with the senator. To take 30% of the power to nuclear capture carbon is something that the United States, nor China, nor India will use. But however, taking 10% of the energy is something palatable. And if coal, let's pretend, 30, 50 years from today, where half renewables and gas and coal and nuclear is the other half. One third, let's just pretend one third. To capture the carbon at a 10% load of half is I get to multiply 0.1 by something and I see electricity bill, maybe 5% more, 10% more. That's a manageable thing. China will, in a heartbeat, jump at that, right? And I think the United States will also. That if you increase the overall electricity bill by 5 or 10%, that's okay.
China doesn't have an EPA that basically says you have broken the law and you've got to stop and cease and desist, and here's the fines you owe.
They do. They do have an EPA.
Well, they might have an EPA, but I can tell you one thing from what I know and what I've seen. They don't use all of the technology they have available to them because it robs the energy they need for their country. Now, the people are pushing back now. They want a cleaner environment. And until that, until the average person or the mass of the people push back enough to get major changes, you won't have it. They put on a good front. They'll show you they have all the technology. They just won't use it.
But that
I actually think it's changing.
It is changing.
And for those of you who have been to China, you know how awful the air pollution can be. For those of you who haven't been, imagine LA and multiply a few times. It's bad.
Pretty
bad. Seriously, seriously bad. And what's happening is you are seeing the beginnings of an environmental anti-pollution movement. Mm-hmm. It's very similar to what happened in the United States and led to the creation of EPA and all.
70s.
Yeah, in the late 60s and 70s, where people started saying, you know, we don't want our children breathing dirty air. I think there's actually a bit of a correlation between the emergence of a middle class as people become more stable, economically stable in their personal lives, their communities, their states. They become more focused on issues like pollution. So you have that happening in China. You have the stability. You have the one-child policy. And there really is an environmental movement. And you know, the President Obama was recently in China and announced a deal with the Chinese, which got a lot of attention on carbon. It is as much for the Chinese, I believe, about conventional pollution as it is about the greenhouse gases. Because everything they are committing to do to drive down their carbon pollution from the burning of fossil fuels will bring with it cleaner air in real time, in the same way that we were able to achieve cleaner air in the United States because EPA had regulations requiring the reduction in pollutants from smokestacks.
Carol, let me just ask one question on that. The president just signed an agreement with the Chinese to reduce their greenhouse gas emissions by 2030?
It starts then, but
no,
it starts
in 2030, right?
Yeah, that's well, when they start
I know. So let me say exactly what the Chinese agreement was. They said by 2030 or earlier, they will cap carbon emissions.
Right.
They will cap coal use. They will start to bring it down. If you look at what China has been doing in the last, I think, 6 years, they've more than doubled their carbon emission. It's gone like that. Now, if you talk, I was there a couple times in the last couple of months in very private conversations with the ministers. They are deadly serious because they see both the climate risk, especially in northern China, the water supply, and the local pollution mix as something. There's a very strong thing. For the first time, the Chinese citizens are saying, I'm willing to pay more to get it clean. This is only in the last couple of years. 5 years ago, you wouldn't hear that. It didn't exist.
Why are they going to wait till 30 to...
No, well, so...
They can clean up the particulates now. They have
they
the technology
are cleaning,
for that.
They are trying to clean... That will be capped. Now, if you talk to them, they'll say, really what we want to do is do it by 2025 or sooner. But if you look at what their carbon emission, it went crazy like that. Okay, and so their part of the agreement, the goal, was actually much more ambitious. Now, if you talk to them privately, they say, no, we want to do it by 2025. We are really serious about this.
But India is ramping up to use more than ever before. India is going unchecked.
India has
right
a different
now.
Set of challenges.
India is not
as controlled. It does not have the same financial wherewithal that China has. But partly to your question, so they still have, what's the percentage of Chinese that don't have electricity, household electricity? They're still looking at having to provide more electricity. So part of we're going to grow, and then we're going to flatten, and then we're going to come down is accounting for the growth in providing more electricity. India has 300 million people without electricity.
Oh, yeah, but China is pledged by 2030, but they're really hoping by 2025, 20% renewable energy by 2020. Okay. They're promising.
Go ahead.
And so, but here's the scenario that's unfolding as we speak. You have a one-child policy. When you have a one kid, you expect in modern China that that child will grow up and live to 70, 80, whatever, okay? A full adult life. And now all of a sudden, this pollution has gotten so bad, and we're still discovering how bad it is in terms of cancer, in terms of emphysema, in terms of, let's say, the verdict is not in. If it turns out that their one child dies at age 50, this is going to be a national tragedy that the government will take the direct hit for. And the, boy, does the government know this.
But they're taking a hit already because they're seeing the same increase in asthma rates among children that we started to experience related to pollution.
But this is going. This is much, much worse than anything we saw in L.A. smog.
I agree it's worse, but the real, they don't have to wait for their children to die early. Their children are experiencing health effects
today. They see
today.
The asthma, and the people in Beijing and further north in Harbin province, they look out at the average air quality 2013 in Beijing as measured by the U.S. Embassy is the equivalent in the airports, you know, those glass smoke-filled rooms that's kind of gray. It's as bad as those.
It's awful.
Average year-round breathing the air in Beijing is as bad as those smoke-filled rooms. That's how bad it is, as measured by the U.S. Embassy, which has started publishing the numbers.
We measure it?
We in the U.S. Embassy measure it.
The embassy?
Yeah. They measure. You know why they measure it?
For their
in
own
part, for their employees, whether or not their kids can go outside. It's about the kids of the embassy going outside.
No. It's bad. It's bad. Bad for anybody.
I went to China in 2007, went to Beijing, and I was going to be over there for 2 weeks. I came back 6 days, and somebody said, are you going to do anything over there? I said, what I found out, this is going to be another one of those places I've been one time. I don't need to go back. I wouldn't go to China, you know, if somebody paid me to.
Let me move you to. Let me move you to another issue quickly. The question is, I don't think I need insurance for this program. Litigation insurance. The answer that everyone is hoping for is obviously renewables. And the question is, you know, how viable are those renewables? And we have a question from the audience on that. What really is the future of alternative resources such as wind and solar when the model they're based on is not self-sustaining, meaning it takes government subsidies to allow these forms of energy development to really function? So, a lot of alternatives out there, you know, not only wind and solar, geothermal, wind energy, all kinds of other alternatives, biomass, ethanol, et cetera.
Ethanol? No, never mind.
Oh, I knew I'd hit a button here somewhere.
Let's just stay on electricity for the moment.
So, you know, how viable are these alternatives, these renewables? And which of the renewables do you think has the best chance of succeeding?
Well, look, since you looked at me, let me right now in the United States, we have tremendous wind resources, especially in the upper Midwest. We have tremendous solar resources in the Southwest. You would need, in order to capture this and use it, you would need a distribution system, an electrical distribution system that actually could port things 1,000 miles. We actually don't have an electrical system that does that. Because, you know, if you only look at locally, you know, the wind stops blowing, the sun stops shining, but the more distant you get, the better it gets. But right now, we're roughly 4.5% wind, we're less than 1% solar today in total electricity generated. That's gonna rapidly changing. We're 6.5% hydro. Within the next 2 or 3 years, wind and solar is gonna overtake hydro. It will easily go to 10%. But here's the thing, and you have to be honest about this. Imagine 30 years from today, we're 50% renewable. The standby backup power is also part of the cost of renewable, because there would be a polar vortex in the Northeast where you get really bad weather for a couple of weeks. You're not going to store batteries for a couple of weeks. You can store day-night, right? You're not going to store seasonal. Mm-hmm. So the real cost of renewables would also include the standby power, that energy on demand that you would need. That is absolutely true. However, 20 years from today, it's going to get very, very good, I think. The renewables will get really inexpensive. I think I've said this publicly, I'll say it to you, within 5 years for wind, 3 years for wind, 4 more years for solar, we don't need subsidy.
So they'd be at price parity.
Yeah, they would be price parity with new natural gas plant if natural gas were $4 a million BTU.
We've been subsidizing wind for 20 years, correct?
We've been subsidizing oil for 100. But who's counting?
So actually, I was asked that in Congress. Don't you think, when is there going to be end to subsidy? And so actually, we've been subsidizing wind and solar since the late 70s, if you really want to start the clock. Mm-hmm. And we've subsidized fossils since the turn of the 20th century, right? If you really want to start the clock.
You're talking about the credits.
Credits, all the tax advantages. So I said, look, we'll make a deal. No more fossil subsidy after 100 years, no more renewables after 50 years. We'll just end them all.
What's fossil subsidy?
An oil depletion allowance is a subsidy, right? That's a tax break.
You would agree with that, right?
Yeah.
Okay. I would say tax advantages, what are called mastered limited partnerships. Mastered limited partnerships are a organization where you guys can invest in. It's a tax law that it makes, it's a favorable treatment that enables you to fund fossil much lower price. That is only available to oil, gas, coal, and gas pipelines.
You're talking about distributions to stockholders?
No, this is, in a partnership, Kinder Morgan is a pipeline company.
Yeah.
It's a master limited partnership. Corporate, there is no corporate.
It's an MLP.
Yeah, that's right. MLP is a master limited partnership. That is a preferred tax advantage that is not open to renewable energy.
Right. Well, but
I think they would take it. They would give up their production tax credits for an MLP. The renewables.
I agree.
In a heartbeat.
But an MLP is, you're just distributing. You're making distributions to share.
Let me explain to the audience what a mastered limited partnership is. If you're a partnership, like a law firm, there is no corporate center. The partners get taxed on whatever income bracket they're in. If you're a corporation, like ExxonMobil, the corporation gets taxed. And then if you're a shareholder, you get taxed.
So there's you get taxed on a dividend.
Correct.
Right.
Yeah. Correct. So in mastered limited partnership, including pretty big things like the biggest pipeline builders in the United States, have no corporate tax. Now, the difference is you can own shares of Kinder Morgan as, it's not a 40-person law firm. It's open to a wider class of investors. Because it's open to a wider class of investors, the money is cheaper. Right? It's a golden rule. If only a few people can loan you, hey, you're going to have to pay their price. If the whole public can own you, as you do in stock, the cost of money for bonds is cheaper.
Well, you're saying Kinder Morgan is tightly held?
No, Kinder Morgan is an example of a master limited partnership.
I understand.
Now, if you're a big solar farm or wind farm, you can't have a master limited partnership. Mm. It's against the law. If you look at the companies in the United States that have this favorable tax treatment, there is no corporate center. There are four industries, and they're the fossil industries: coal, oil, gas, and gas pipelines. I would love it if the United States Congress can allow wind and solar to have a master limited partnership, and get rid of the investment tax credit. And get rid of the oil depletion allowances and a few other things.
And get rid of the MLP.
Let me try to grab this thing. We got about 15 minutes left.
We're in tax policy now.
Let me try to get as short an answer as I can get as we ask these questions. There's a ban on exporting crude oil that's been in place because of the concern about price shock and obviously trying to protect our security, but we've got an awful lot. As you pointed out, we're close to independence in terms of the amount of oil we're producing. Isn't it time to get rid of the ban on exporting crude? We could obviously help supply countries in Eastern Europe that are under blackmail from Russia with regards to energy. Is it time to end the ban on exporting oil and gas?
Exporting crude.
Crude.
Heavy crude. Let me just say, we just had a hearing on this. And basically not just the crude, but also an LNG, but we'll talk about crude right now. And it's hard for the average person, hard for people in West Virginia to say, okay, if you open up and allow crude to be exported, knowing that we're importing crude, that I can make them understand that it might be cheaper, the gasoline might be cheaper at the pump. It doesn't really resonate. It doesn't make sense how we can export while we're still importing, but yet it'll be cheaper. My take on this, and we were talking in a hearing, is I said, if we're going to export, I know market forces, it basically changes the Brent pricing, mm-hmm. right? If we put more oil in the global market than just the North.
Explain what you mean by Brent.
It's the pricing basically that the OPEC has established. And it's the price that most of the world oil is moved on, except American, North American. Ours is moved under the WTI. So we're different pricing.
But there's an arbitrage between Brent and WTI of about $10.
It's bigger than it's ever been right now.
Right.
No, it's been more than this.
So anyway, let me just say,
somebody give me an answer.
In a nutshell, I don't think the American public, I don't think the public would support we voting in Congress saying that we're going to have open export of crude now, knowing that we're still buying. I think that you, and I know people in West Virginia, if we had a policy based on that we would export for strategic purposes, for our national interest, our security of our nation, helping those countries basically where they're held captive by Russia and other oil.
Yeah, but who's going to make a decision whether this is
EPA? Well, somebody's got to.
Great idea.
Boone, are you for or against still lifting the ban?
I'd export because it will. Level out Brent and WTI is what will happen. And I agree to a guy sitting out there saying, I don't get it. You're going to export and we're importing. We got a ship going out and one passing right there coming in.
Doesn't make sense. It's going to be cheaper.
Yeah. And it's hard to sell that.
Carol?
But I'm for it.
Look, oil is a global commodity. It is basically priced globally. I think we should fully participate in the global market. I think we will reap the greatest amount of benefits. But having said that, we should use less of it.
We should what?
Use less of it.
Steve.
It's not good for the environment.
Steve, yes or no?
I think it's all right. People will not understand this two-way flow because it goes into the details of refineries and what they can refine and not refine. Okay? That our refineries are currently set up to refine a certain type of oil and not the other type of oil. And that's why you can send ships this way and it would be cheaper. But I would agree with the senator. The public's not going to understand.
There's serious debate going on whether we do it or not. It's yet to be seen.
All right, California.
I'm still answering the question. You are on exporting oil. Every day you export 4 million barrels of product from the refinery.
That's right.
Big export
in the United States.
But not crude.
So,
right.
Yeah.
We export gas, but not crude. No,
we export mostly diesel.
Well, fuel.
Diesel.
That's why the price is so high on diesel.
Yeah. All right. California recently implemented a cap and trade program. How that operates. Do you see that as a viable way to regulate greenhouse gases?
I would like something much simpler, something that can't be gamed. I would like something that it's clear signals. It can start very, very low. I think the California cap and trade has a floor on it.
It does.
And that's good. And it also has a ceiling. Yep. So you have some market efficiency, but it can't be gamed as much as Europe gamed it.
Europe messed it up.
Europe messed it up completely,
right.
and they know that.
Right.
And
they had the cap and trade.
They had a cap and trade.
They didn't manage it properly. They had way too many allowances out there. They weren't getting the kind of market behavior. Look, the whole idea of cap and trade comes from the 1990 Clean Air Act. It was a Republican idea. It was to deal with the acid rain problem rather than putting regulations on each smokestack to reduce SOX, sulfur dioxide. It was to allow industry to figure out how they would meet a cap, an overall cap, and if your facility was above, you might lower the emissions, or you might buy credits from somebody who was below. It had a huge impact in terms of achieving an environmental outcome and doing it in a very, very cost-effective manner, far more cost-effective.
This was a great Republican idea, you're saying.
I just said so, yes. I gave you credit.
In Bush 1.
Bush 1,
it was a pioneer. Yeah, Bush 1.
This is a hugely important concept that got embodied in the Clean Air Act of 1990.
I'm going to take this back to my camp.
Okay, we'll do that. And I think that on a sector-by-sector basis, now what Henry Waxman and Markey and all of us tried to figure out how to do was take that very successful program and apply it economy-wide. That turned out to be, first of all, it ended up not having the votes, but it was just way, way complicated.
Yeah.
But
that's
on
the one
a sector,
I shot.
That's the one he shot, yeah. On a sector-by-sector basis, which is what California is looking at doing, it can make, I think, an awful lot of sense in terms, again, of finding the economic efficiency. And what California, they just auctioned off the credits that people need to emit and to, you know, bring down the pollution. You guys just generated $1 billion in revenue that will come back into whether it's mass transit, high-speed rail, that's for you all to debate. But what they're showing is that you can achieve an environmental gain, you can generate revenue, which is all good news. So will we ever get there nationally? I don't think in the near term, but what is very likely is the states start to grapple with reducing carbon emissions from power plants, which is EPA has proposed and will finalize later this year. If that goes into effect or when that
I'm
goes
not
into
leaving.
Effect. I think states will opt into programs like California's.
All right, let me ask you all the same question I asked you with the students. Steve made the point that when looking out at the students that ultimately, you know, the whole issue is whether or not we're going to make their lives better. It's the dream of our parents to make sure that our children's lives are better. And they're going to grow, you know, into a world in which they're going to be facing these challenges related to energy. So I want to ask each of you very quickly, do you think that in the next 30 or 40 years that we in fact will have a better energy program, one that does reduce the threat and moves to renewables, or do you think in 40 years we're going to pretty much be in the same place? Joe?
I think we'll be better. I think that we will develop technology. We'll use, if we can adopt an all-in energy policy until we have the fuel of the future, and that's going to be 3-4 decades down the road probably, if not more. But I think that we can move forward, and we can show the rest of the world it can be done. We have to also be willing to change our trading policies too. I mean, we can't let people have an open market, open access to our markets with no quid pro quo, if you will. If we're going to abide by these laws with a new technology, then we should say, if a global fix, it's going to take everyone participating on this beautiful globe of ours. And we have the ability with a $17 trillion GDP to do that. We're not using the might of our markets. We're just not doing it. We're talking a good game, but we're not doing anything with it.
Okay, Boone, we going to be better or not?
Oh, we'll be better, sure.
Will you be here? Will you be here?
Absolutely.
I'll try to.
Okay, good. Perfect.
Carol?
No kidding. Okay. I mean, sure we're going to be better. All
right.
We're not fools. And, we're going to be better.
Okay, Carol?
So, by better, I'll define what better means to me, which is we are reducing our carbon pollution, and I think we will be. I think we will transition to a new energy economy much more rapidly than any of us anticipate, because once we get going, it will be a no-brainer.
I would agree with Carol. I was astounding how fast solar prices have fallen in the last 4 years. It's just shocking. It would better than my wildest dreams.
Doctor, give them an example of what you're paying for average coal, what you're paying for maybe nuke, and what you're paying for gas, what you might be, if you can just roughly.
Okay, so a new natural gas plant, it depends on what you price natural gas at.
Quickly.
And so five cents a kilowatt hour.
5 cents.
Wind with the production tax credit, without taking out the production tax credit, it's less than 6 cents today. It's really less than 3 cents with the production tax credit. Solar is now selling, contracts in Texas are now selling for 5 cents a kilowatt hour. Okay? So it was shocking how fast that came down. So
New coal is
way out of the lead because of all the emissions requirements.
Coal used to be at 3 and 4 cents in our
state.
But
it's not. It's not a new coal plant.
Let me bring this to a close by saying, I think the greatest thing for the United States is our ability to innovate and to be creative.
That's right.
That's what will bring us the future with regards to cleaner energy.
Leon,
let me thank all of you for participating. We're at an end.